Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, episode number 204. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. On today's episode, we're going to be chatting with the one and only Matt Bromley about some cutting-edge intel coming out of the Lima Charlie Community Forum. Another week brings another wave of threat actors, malicious payloads, and compromised systems. In today's episode, we'll be diving into some of the latest intelligence being shared by our incredible Lima Charlie community. A huge shout out to everyone who contributes. It's because of your insights that we can keep these discussions going. And I brought this up last week, but we'll keep saying it for a few weeks to come. We're moving from our Slack channel. We have 1,700 members over there and a lot of information gets shared, but because we're on a community edition, the history gets blown away. So Slack has the paywall set up. If you don't have a paid account, you have a limited amount of history. So we love the way Slack works, but it's really unfortunate that we lose all that collective knowledge we're putting together. So we've decided to make a move over to a new platform called Discourse. A lot of you are probably familiar with it. I think Elastic and some of the other big communities out there are using it. It's more of a forum type experience, but it's got a searchable history and we'll be able to really build that collective knowledge over time in a way that's useful and can be utilized going forward. So if you're on Slack, you got to go create a new account at community.limacharlie.io. And if you haven't joined us yet, jump in at community.limacharlie.io. I'm sure it'll be a good time. You should come check it out. We're going to have both platforms running for the time being, but we'll be sunsetting Slack at some point in the not too distant future. So if you want to continue to be a part of the intel sharing that all these chats are based on and get information in real time, go sign up one more time, community.limacharlie.io. Again, community.limacharlie.io. And I feel like I've done my ShamWow commercial now. As always, I'm joined by the articulate Globetrotter himself, the one and only Matt Bromley. How are you doing today, sir?
Chris, how's it going, sir? I'm doing well, doing well. I'm going to keep my current geography secret. I will display what it is next week, only because I had a little bit of travel snafu on the way here, but that's totally okay. Weather is weather. We can't change it. We can't alter it. But that being said, it's great to be with you again. Looking forward to it. We've got actually a really big announcement, I think, first. Not an announcement for us, just an announcement to talk about. But a lot has happened since you and I last caught, including somebody spending, I think, upwards of $32 billion in cash.
Yeah, it's hard not to talk about this one. As I'm sure anybody listening has heard, Google has announced a $32 billion all-cash acquisition of the Israeli cybersecurity startup Wiz, making it one of the largest deals in the company's history. So to be clear, all cash is briefcases of cash. Usually these transactions at this size are done in stock and other things. They're tied to the success of the union, but Google threw cash on the table. So for those that don't know, Wiz specializes in cloud security, offering a platform that helps businesses detect vulnerabilities, misconfigurations, and threats across multi-cloud environments. The company has gained significant traction by providing agentless scanning, meaning it can assess cloud infrastructure without requiring software to be installed on each individual workload. This approach has been a key differentiator, allowing for rapid deployment and broad security coverage across major cloud platforms like AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud. Google's decision to acquire Wiz aligns with its broader strategy of strengthening cloud security, particularly as competition with Microsoft and Amazon in the cloud market continues to escalate. I think we saw last year they turned down $29 billion or something like that, and everybody threw their hands up, and here we are again.
Hey, hats off to the clairvoyancy over at Wiz, who knew to just hang on and just wait because you never know what's going to happen. Another $3 billion might show up, and then it's all cash as it shows up too. I think, Chris, I know you're going to talk about this, but I think this just continues to demonstrate Google establishing, or I should say continuing to establish themselves as a multifaceted leader in the market here. Now, folks, let me be clear. I'm not paid to say this, nor am I giving Google any unnecessary props. I am a former employer of Mandiant, which is now part of Google Cloud Security, and that's kind of where my experience draws from. They're picking up these really solid companies that are offering, you know, great value to what they want to build out as an overall, very extensive, very complete security platform. And I think, you know, I'm not going to say, Chris, we're going to continue to see this happening. I think they're being very strategic in what they're acquiring and what they're bringing on. I'm not an M&A expert, so I'm definitely not the best resource on this, but I will say for anyone who might be a Wiz customer and is like, what do I do now? You're about to join a pretty successful ecosystem. And to your point, Chris, there is some heating up competition. I know you're going to talk about this in just a second here, but I think it just continues to show that Google Cloud is a major player in the game. And if anyone ever doubted it, I mean, here's the proof.
Yeah, and I think it also points towards, you know, part of Lima Charlie's thesis where the future of security looks more like any cloud provider. I imagine Wiz will be integrated with the larger GCP platform and you'll sort of get services in the same way that you get other services from the cloud.
We would hope so. We would hope to see that. I do know, and just a quick note for anyone here in case you're worried about what do I do tomorrow? These integrations take years, you know, anywhere from 18 months to sometimes 3 to 4 years for these massive integrations, depending on the size of the code base being brought in, the size of the company and whatnot. So it's not like if you're a Wiz customer today, you're a Google customer tomorrow. It's not the way it works. But I do think it just continues to kind of go down the road of like, this is what the future of security looks like. This isn't just any normal acquisition. You know, Chris, I think you're starting to see like this is a cloud provider building and establishing themselves as the forefront of security, not a security company trying to acquire all the pieces and stuff like that, right? I think there's a little bit of a different take there. So curious to see what, you know, 3-4 years from now, like GCP looks like as an overall platform.
Yeah. So this acquisition builds on Google's previous investment in cybersecurity, such as its $5.4 billion purchase of Mandiant in 2022. With cloud adoption growing, security has become a top priority for enterprises, and Google is positioning itself as a leader in the space. Wiz, which reached a valuation of $10 billion in 2023, has been on one of the fastest growing cybersecurity startups, attracting major enterprise customers and significant venture capital investment. By bringing Wiz under its umbrella, Google is not only enhancing its security offering, but also preventing key competitors from acquiring a leading cloud security player. The next challenge will be integrating Wiz's technology into Google Cloud's existing security stack while maintaining support for multi-cloud environments. Given Google's history of acquisitions and product integrations, the industry will be watching closely to see how this move impacts a broader cloud security landscape. So yeah, Matt, I think we touched on all of that. It's definitely interesting to see these things be brought together and sit here and think about what the future of security might look like.
You know, even more interesting, Chris, we might be here in a few years being like, hey, here's what it turned into.
Yes. 200 episodes now, I can't imagine 300 and 400.
Oh my goodness. Hey man, fingers crossed. We'll just go one by one.
That's right. All right. Next up, a newly discovered zero-day vulnerability in Windows allows attackers to escalate privileges, potentially granting them full control over affected systems. The flaw, which has not yet been patched, affects multiple versions of Windows, including Windows 10, Windows 11, and several editions of Windows Server. Security researchers identified the issue in the Windows kernel, where it can be exploited to bypass key security features like user account control, or UAC. Microsoft has officially acknowledged a vulnerability, but has yet to release a fix. In the meantime, they're investigating the issue, and a patch is expected in an upcoming security update. So for once, we can't tell folks to go patch.
Not yet, but when the patch comes out, we can say go patch. I mean, come on now.
Wait for the patch.
So for anyone curious, I think Chris is going to dig into this one a little bit further. We might have some more details about this one, but on the surface, for anyone who's curious, hasn't heard of this one, this is a vulnerability that will take advantage, or not will, but does take advantage of LNK files or shortcut or link files in Windows. It hides command line arguments inside of them that can then subsequently execute malicious payloads and everything like that. I want to be clear about some determination for someone here. Whenever you read it, and this is Chris and I kind of quoting like the blog posts and the security advisories and things like that. Whenever you hear about, you know, this vulnerability might be used to allow for complete computer takeover and that kind of stuff, what that really translates to is this is a thing that, you know, right now there may not be any patches in place, and it can successfully run commands, or it can run code, which can lead to the running of an exploit kit or lead to the running of a C2 or something like that, right? It's also been in our experience that sometimes it leads to the running of a coin miner. So, you know, who cares at that point? But point being, this is an abuse of LNK files. And where this gets super interesting, and Chris, I know you've got some more insight into kind of what's available and what's out there, but I do want to mention this came out to us from Trend, aka Trend Micro. They've given it kind of their own zero-day initiative code, which I don't think it tracks directly to the CVE or the CVSS or whatever, but they have their own Trend zero-day initiative thing. And they've identified this. Where it gets concerning is they've already identified nearly 1,000 of these things out in the wild. Furthermore, they've been able to link and tie those back to state-sponsored APT groups from North Korea, Iran, Russia, and China, which if you're a North American, is pretty much the four aces. You got a full house at this point. And of course, the targets have been North America, Europe, Asia, South America, and Australia. So if you were to just kind of read this, you would read a crazy vulnerability that impacts all versions of Windows used by all the nation state threat actors and applicable to every single nation that's out there. Folks, let's be clear, easy with those tinfoil hats.
And no patch available.
And no patch available and POC code out there, right? This is one of those situations where we've got a vulnerability or, you know, a zero day has been detected. It is allegedly being used by multiple threat groups that are out there, meaning it's in the wild. It has been seen out there. But all this is a chance for us to, you know, write detections, figure out how this stuff's been used, and then look for it in our environment until a patch comes out and then actually get this thing kind of, you know, tied down.
And I swear we talk about LNK files about half a dozen times a year. If those things are not instrumental to your business, it's probably something to consider disabling.
That's going to be tough. Shortcut links and LNK files are an inherent part of Windows. For anyone, you know, who's familiar done Windows forensics, you're going to know immediately, like, this is a valuable evidence source, number one. But number two, Chris, it's so integrated into how Microsoft does what it does, and it's so integrated into the user experience that it would be very tough. I think where it becomes maybe where the problem should be solved is we should look at different available telemetry sources, defenders, and then look for LNK files showing up in places we wouldn't expect them to show up, right? Even though they are integral to users and the user experience inside of Windows, they aren't files that users typically kind of carry around or move around or play with. They interact with them, but they're in kind of predefined locations. What I'm trying to get at here is you wouldn't expect to see an LNK file in email, right? That would not be normal. You wouldn't expect to see them in certain user locations. Technically, they can show up anywhere, but there's just things that you can kind of rule out of the anomalies. It's like, I wouldn't expect this thing to be in here. And then furthermore, if you see LNKs as part of a potentially malicious process tree, that's another huge indicator too that something is wrong in this case.
Okay, yeah, I'm not much of a Windows guy. I thought it was pinning stuff to the dock at the bottom of the screen and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, it that's part of it. Like, part of those can be LNK files, but they show up in recents, they show up in start menu items. If I open a document, it shows up as, you know, something like a potential shortcut somewhere. It's an integral part of the operating system, and it's tough to say, hey, let's just turn that thing off. It's more, and this is the danger, right? This is the issue with vulnerabilities like this, is it is so inherently part of Windows. We can't just flip the switch and turn it off. We've got to find ways to detect and find them.
All right. Well, there are already reports of the vulnerability being exploited in the wild, with evidence suggesting that targeted attacks are taking place. Additionally, proof of concept exploit code is surfaced online, raising concerns about widespread abuse by cyber criminals. Researchers warn that attackers could use this vulnerability to gain system-level access, install malware, steal sensitive data, or move laterally within networks. As a temporary measure, security experts recommend limiting administrative privileges, enabling endpoint detection response solutions, and closely monitoring system logs for unusual activity. Organizations with high security environments should take an extra precaution until an official patch is released. This incident underscores a persistent challenge of securing Windows systems against privilege escalation exploits, which remain a common target for attackers looking to gain deeper access to compromised networks. So yeah, I think we've covered all of that. Too bad we can't turn them off.
I wish we could. I wish there was an easier way to do it, but I know all my forensicators out there will be like, no, these are great, valuable sources of evidence. Don't turn them off.
All right. So security researchers have identified new intrusion techniques used by the SOC Ghoulish malware framework, which is...
Not sure.
Yeah. I used to think it was SOC Ghoulish, but there's no U there. So it's Ghoulish, SOC Ghoulish malware framework.
I'm not sure. I mean, again, we're back in the world of, like, who named these things, but whatever.
Yeah. Which is increasingly being leveraged to distribute ransomware. SOC Ghoulish is a JavaScript-based malware known for its ability to infect legitimate websites and trick users into downloading fake software updates. These fraudulent updates act as an entry point for attackers, allowing them to deploy additional malware and establish initial access to a target network. According to Trend Micro's latest research, threat actors are now using SOC Ghoulish infections as a launchpad for ransomware attacks, demonstrating an evolution in their tactics to maximize damage and financial pain. So that anytime you can see stuff like this just on a infected from a website or something like that, it's pretty terrifying, because you start to get into, like, malvertising and just directing people who may not be super aware to sites where they can get this stuff into computers.
Yeah, agreed. And by the way, a quick hat tip to the folks at Trend. This is the second time in just as many briefs that you're showing up in our feed here. So hats off, Trend, for some great recent analysis of stuff coming out. I'm with you in the same boat here, Chris. This is, you know, something that is I think a little bit more of a dangerous entry vector than a lot of folks realize. And, you know, the compromise of legitimate websites, injecting malicious scripts into hijacking user traffic and stuff like that. This is one of those situations where you've got a lot of probably unsuspecting users not knowing what they're looking for. And then when something comes up or, you know, there's a drive-by or something like that, they're not really too sure how to handle it. Some of them click, yes, go ahead, install the fake update or whatever it is, not knowing that they've kind of like given up, you know, all the secrets and stuff, or that they've given up access to a system. Where this one gets a little bit, I think, more tricky is, and we've talked at length before about kind of like the ransomware as a business model and stuff like that. However, these newer intrusion sets actually tie and lead back to Ransom Hub ransomware deployment. And I think where that becomes a little, you know, more concerning is that you've got a pretty well-known, very active, very prolific ransomware operator kind of taking advantage of this technique for their initial access. So it's like an expert handing off to an expert, as opposed to, you know, maybe someone who's maybe a mile wide and an inch deep. You've got mile deep handing off to mile deep and, you know, very, very skilled adversaries there. And I think that just makes it even trickier, Chris, because again, we don't like to compliment threat actors, but they've called in the A-team, if you will, and it just makes them more successful, opens up more attacks for them to find success in, and unfortunately more ransoms.
Yeah. So one of the primary techniques observed involves the abuse of remote administrative tools and stolen credentials to move laterally within compromised networks. Attackers rely on living off the land binaries, or LOL bins, and PowerShell scripts to evade traditional security defenses while executing malicious commands. In many cases, after gaining a foothold, they deploy tools like Cobalt Strike to establish command and control or C2 communication, exfiltrate sensitive data, and prepare the system for a full-scale ransomware attack. Before encryption, attackers often disable security measures such as endpoint protection, making detection and mitigation more challenging. Security experts recommend that organizations take proactive steps such as monitoring for unusual administrative activity, restricting PowerShell execution, and deploying endpoint detection and response solutions. Given the increasing sophistication of these attacks, businesses must remain vigilant as a single compromised endpoint can lead to widespread network disruption and financial losses. Feel like we're preaching to the choir at this point.
I think we're just continuing to highlight the fact that these adversaries can be pretty dangerous. So it's a chance for everyone to kind of, you know, be vigilant, keep your eyes open, and watch out. You never know what these threat actors are going to come at you with next.
All right. Next up, we have security researchers have uncovered a new technique that allows attackers to disable endpoint detection response solutions using Windows Defender Application Control, or WDAC. WDAC is a Windows security feature designed to enforce application whitelisting and prevent unauthorized code execution. However, threat actors have found a way to misuse WDAC policies to disable EDR processes, effectively neutralizing security defenses on compromised systems. This technique is particularly concerning because it does not rely on malware execution, but instead leverages built-in Windows functionality to bypass security controls. So I guess the threat actors just figure out what the process looks like for the EDR, and they put it on the list of stuff that's not allowed to run, and Robert's your mother's brother.
Nice. Yeah, I think this is yet another, it's not novel to see threat actors abusing inherent built-in Windows systems, but it definitely, you know, can be a cause for concern. If anything, only because not a lot of folks know how to either defend against this or even how to detect it, right? And you've got a threat actor who's taking advantage of the Windows Defender application control. I will admit and say to everyone here that in order for this attack to even be successful, you do need administrative access on the system. So there's like one chance, you know, one hurdle to give the threat actors there if you want. But interestingly enough, what it does is it allows them to essentially disable the EDR that's on the in the environment. I know Chris is going to talk about this a little bit further, but that becomes a pretty dangerous and risky capability for the threat actors to have, is when they can no longer necessarily need to say, oh, if it's this EDR, I don't know a way around it, or, you know, maybe they only have the ability to circumvent certain ones. Now they can just utilize this built-in Windows functionality, which is automatically enabled on Windows 10 and 11 and then Server 2016 and above all the way up to 2025. And it works. Like, it's a way to utilize a built-in policy, if you will, to disable EDR from running. And all you need are admin rights. And notice how I kind of flipped the script on that and said, all you need are admin rights. Yes, you need them. They're required. But a lot of times, unfortunately, in a lot of environments out there, Chris, people are running as local admin. The account that gets compromised is a local admin account. And that's just a tough spot to be in. My advice for anyone here would definitely be to, first off, read up on the blog post. A hat tip over to Beasley Security, who I'd actually never interacted with before, but great post, number one. Number two, read up on this one. It does say they are working with some of the EDR vendors to look for indicators or look for detections to be put into place. Chris, I know you're going to talk a little bit more about some mitigations out there, but this is one that for anyone who's in charge of a Windows environment, I would recommend reading up on this and getting wise about this particular threat. I think there's some neat things to discover inside of your environment.
So the attack involves modifying or deploying a malicious WDAC policy that blocks EDR components from running, preventing them from detecting or responding to threats. Since WDAC operates at the kernel level, its policies are enforced before most security tools can intervene. Researchers note that this method is stealthier than traditional EDR bypass techniques such as process injection or unhooking API calls because it does not generate typical indicators of compromise. To mitigate this risk, security experts recommend enforcing strict access controls on WDAC policy modifications, monitoring for unexpected changes to security configurations, and ensuring that administrative privileges are tightly restricted as attackers continue to find new ways to disable security solutions using native Windows features. Organizations must adopt a proactive defense strategy to detect and prevent these types of attacks. So Matt, I'm curious, if I do manage to turn off EDR, how much time does that buy me to go to town and do whatever I want before somebody notices?
Yeah, well, there's a catch-22 inside of that, Chris, which is that if the EDR doesn't know it's been turned off, how do you find out that it's been turned off, right? It's like turning the light off in a room that no one's in. Like, if no one's there to know that it's dark, how do you know? So one of the first things is if there's any sort of anti-tampering capabilities, that's one thing to watch out for. The big issue here for anyone who might be like, oh, we have anti-tampering protection on, the big issue here is that anti-tampering, first off, it might just indicate, hey, this thing was attempted, but there's no follow-up event to say it was successful, because if it was successful, it doesn't have the ability to send the event. So you're kind of wrapped like in an infinite loop there. But the other thing to look for is unexpected differences in your EDR population. I know that there are some tools out there that will assist with this. And you can even put alerts in and whatnot. Of course, this gets a little tricky because there are a ton of systems out there, laptops, for example, that I do expect to go on and offline all the time. But you could easily build in some rules or capabilities that say, hey, servers, I would expect to see every 5 minutes or, you know, whatever the check-in window is, I would expect to see them there. If those things don't check in, flag and notify and let me know immediately. I think those, Chris, are like out of the box table stakes detections that everyone should have. There is no situation where I don't want to know if my EDR is not working. So I would recommend to anyone and everyone out there, if you're deploying some sort of a EDR that is a little less hands-on and you're kind of just like monitoring a dashboard or something like that, make sure there's an uptime alert or something built in there of like, hey, this system, which is in a group that should be online all the time, hasn't checked in a while. Is this expected? That's something I would want to know about. For me, this falls in the same category of like Windows event logs being cleared for a long time. And I still believe that's an event that you should alert on every single time. Because if it's a threat actor, great, you caught them destroying evidence. If it's not a threat actor, there should be an admin right behind that who can say, oh, yes, that was me. Otherwise, there's something suspicious going on. Same situation. Why did the EDR agent stop checking in? Oh, we're rebooting that system for known scheduled maintenance. Perfect. Security noted. Moving on. And we're done. Otherwise, why is this thing not reporting in? Because we need that telemetry. So that's the way I'd first go about approaching something like this, Chris, is like, don't rely on anti-tampering detection to work. Drop in other measures such as this thing hasn't checked in and use that, I think, as a way to say, hey, there's an issue here.
Would there be any way to correlate activity from a particular endpoint on the network that would then correlate with the EDR being alive or not? Because I get your point about laptops going offline, but if the EDR is not checking in and then I see traffic going through my network from this endpoint, I got to know something's up.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting towards other types of telemetry now, which may or may not exist. A lot of organizations I know don't have that type of network insight. I mean, I agree with you. If you could do that, if you could be like, hey, there's based on traffic, there's 1,000 endpoints, you know, communicating and we've only got 900 represented in our EDR dashboard. Where's the you know, the issue here? I would love to have that type of thing in place. It's a very tough sell though for a lot of orgs. They're not going to have that out there. What I would maybe look for instead is if you're utilizing some sort of log forwarding, that's another way folks to look for discrepancies of like, wait a second, I, you know, 5 minutes ago I had a system sending logs here and EDR there, and now I only have logs coming up. Is there anything? Is there a process tree listed or something like that? The biggest issue, though, Chris, is there's a huge reliance on EDR telemetry. So if you take that away, it kind of is like, well, it's like blowing out the candle in the dark. It's like, okay, now go find the flashlight. It's like, well, how do I go find a flashlight, you know?
Yeah, well, at least like the servers and stuff are going to be where the crown jewels are, so to speak. So we know those should be online. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of what I was getting at, was looking for the systems that you expect to be online. And then if those aren't there, account for it. And again, if you have an environment, everyone, I like to remind folks of this. If you have an environment that's like 1,000 systems, let's just use easy math for discussion's sake. If you have an environment that's 1,000 systems, and let's just say hypothetically you have 800 users and you have, you know, 200 servers, and I'm just using basic math, 80-20, and you're like, oh, well, that rule is only, you know, Matt, your uptime rule is only applicable to 20% of my environment. So what? It's better than zero, right? It's better than zero. And I think a lot of times when it comes to like detection engineering, we tend to let perfection get in the way of progress of like, well, how do I build the rule that applies to my entire environment? It's not going to happen. It's not going to be out there. You got to take it in chunks. You got to go piece by piece. And if you can say, okay, I have 1,000 systems. This 20%, I've got great detection and monitoring and fences built around them. I'll deal with the other 80. You free your sock up to do other stuff as well, as opposed to running down false positives all the time as to like, oh, is this thing legitimate? I don't know, because we never took the time to classify our host sets. I think host set and host type classification is some of the best quick and internal enrichment any team can do, so that you can quickly say like, oh, okay, this is a server. I would expect it to have these properties. Do those check out? No, that's an anomaly. As opposed to, this is a laptop and it's a user and it's an intern, for example. I'm not expecting the same profile of responsible behavior that I would expect from a 20-year, you know, employee. Use those to your advantage.
All right. Last one for us today. Security researchers have discovered undocumented commands in a widely used Bluetooth chip, potentially exposing over a billion devices to security risks. These commands, which were not disclosed in official documentation, provide low-level access to the chip's firmware, allowing attackers to manipulate device behavior or bypass security mechanisms. The affected chips are used in a wide range of devices, including smartphones, laptops, tablets, and IoT products. The researchers found that these hidden instructions could be abused to alter Bluetooth settings, inject malicious code, or even disable security features entirely. The discovery raises concerns about supply chain security and the transparency of hardware vendors regarding undocumented functionality in their products. Now, we'll get into more of the details in a minute, but I swear we covered this exact thing like a year ago.
Chris, are you going to talk about my toothbrush being connected to the internet? I'm surprised we're just finding this now. Like, how do you hide commands this long? How do you hide undocumented commands this long into something that's been used and over? By the way, I don't know about you, Chris. I feel like I'm either reading an Oracle Java slogan or a McDonald's hamburger slogan of like, this chip is seen in over 1 billion devices. I don't doubt that there's usage in a billion devices. I just doubt that at least 30% of those aren't sitting on shelves somewhere. So let's be clear and say it's not a billion active devices that are out there, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, or landfills or bedside drawers. I mean,
exactly. Or no batteries. So, you know, they don't work anymore. But, you know, this is, I found to be a pretty interesting one here, especially as this comes up. First off, I'm surprised it's taken this long. I feel like the moment something new comes out, there's people who just tear it apart. And the fact that this thing was able to get to this level of prolific deployment before anybody was like, oh my God, there's hidden commands in here. Who knows what they're used for? Who knows why they're put in there? I mean, I just got to remind everyone here, like in these situations, first off, we've already kind of talked ad nauseum about like what to do with IoT devices and networks and segment them and don't even connect to the internet if you don't need to. The flip side of that is these commands didn't show up. They're not like, you know, what are those things in Tron Legacy, the like entity that show up or whatever. I forget what they're called, the algorithm, you know, whatever they're called. But that being said, they don't just majestically appear. Someone had to go in and actually code these things. You know what I mean? Isomorphic algorithms, that's what they're called, isomorphs. These don't just appear out of nowhere. Someone had to go in and code these things. So I can't help, Chris, but start to wonder, like, why? Why'd you code this in there? Why'd you put it in here? Of course, the blog post starts off with made by a Chinese manufacturer. We're going to stop with that assumption right there and assume this was done maliciously. Maybe someone forgot to document. Who knows? It happens. But I find this to be one that, like, Chris, is not going to be solved by, okay, let's all burn down Bluetooth, right? I think this is a situation where everyone should be able to read this type of a blog post. And unless you're one of these manufacturers, if you're a consumer of these, your response should be, okay, good, I've got this stuff segmented off, so it shouldn't be that big of a deal. You know, if you're running all these things on the same network, segment them. I mean, that's going to be your best approach or your best way to mitigate this.
Yeah. And if I understand it correctly, you still need to be within the 30 feet that Bluetooth transmits to take advantage of this. So it's not a widespread zero day that's going to take society down. It's more of a in the lab thing. Look at how smart I am. I figured this out.
Anytime you've got a proximity requirement in there, as you do with Bluetooth, you know, 10 meters, 30 feet, whatever it is, obviously that's going to limit your capabilities for exploitation as well.
All right. So exploiting these hidden commands requires proximity to the target device and specialized knowledge of the chip's architecture. However, once accessed, an attacker could gain significant control over Bluetooth communications, potentially intercepting or modifying data transmissions. In some cases, this could enable device tracking or man-in-the-middle attacks without the user's knowledge. Security experts warn that these undocumented commands could also be leveraged to create persistent backdoors, especially in high-value targets such as corporate networks or government infrastructure. To mitigate the risk, researchers recommend that manufacturers release firmware updates to restrict or properly document these commands. This discovery highlights a broader issue of undocumented features and hardware components, emphasizing the need for greater transparency and security scrutiny in embedded systems. And yeah, like to your point earlier, it is wild that given how widely Bluetooth is deployed and studied and hacked at, all the Flipper Zero folks out there, like it took this long for people to find these undocumented commands. And it kind of makes you wonder about the chips in your vehicle, maybe the chips in some fighter jets or missiles. You know, there's a lot of places these things can hide.
You never know. You never know. Toothbrushes. You never know where they're going to show up. But this is... Again, for anyone out there who's like, if you're a manufacturer of these devices and you're listening to this podcast, first off, thank you so much, number one. Number two, if you're someone who just utilizes these devices, please segment, or if you don't need to connect to the internet, don't. I want to be clear that when you see stats like, you know, 1 billion devices, I think that's devices manufactured. I don't think it's devices sold. I don't think it's devices deployed. I'm sure there's a few hundred million sitting on shelves and that kind of stuff, but... That being said, just, you know, segment these things off if you need to. Don't connect them. Disable Bluetooth if you don't need to, or only use it when you need to. You know, one of the devices that comes to mind for me, Chris, is, you know, for example, I also sometimes worry about like the inherent danger here, you know. So I've got a Bluetooth speaker that I use like at the gym and stuff like that. And it's a Bluetooth speaker. It's exactly that. I connect it to my phone via Bluetooth. I play songs and then we're done. Someone takes root control of that thing via undocumented commands. I'm like, okay, I'll just hold down the button and reset it and stuff like that. Like, I'm not connecting it to any sort of network. I think where the danger comes in for some folks, the perceived danger is, oh, I have an IoT connected device that also has Bluetooth built in. Therefore, there's maybe another way to get to it and that kind of stuff. It's a different protocol. It's a different protocol, folks. You can't hop in over one and then immediately transfer to the other because Bluetooth has a proximity requirement. So segment them off if you're super nervous about it. But otherwise, if you don't need Bluetooth, disable it. I mean, it's not really necessary all the time.
Yeah. And on that note, I sure miss my 1/8-inch stereo jack. All right. It was a fun one, Matt. Thanks for coming out again. We'll keep your location a secret until next week, I guess.
There we go. I'll tell everyone next week where I am, just because this week's a little bit of a... It's actually the same location. I'm just being secretive for no reason, Chris.
Nothing to do with the giant protests that are taking place there right now, right?
Nothing to do at all. No, I have left the protesting area. I will say that much. But I have returned to another country that is full of protests. But we'll leave that off to the side.
Okay. Till next week, sir.
Take care. See ya.
Bye. And that concludes this episode of the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas for future topics, please send an email to defenders@limacharlie.io. You can access the intel we talk about on the show in real time and join the conversation on the Lima Charlie Community Slack channel at slack.limacharlie.io. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider sharing it with someone or leaving a rating or review. And don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening from. Thanks for listening in. We'll see you on the next episode.